This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, where every week, in half an hour with the help of top experts, we try as best we can to understand a big issue. This is the first of three special podcasts which all focus on the same theme, the future of health. In the next episode, we're asking why there appears to be an epidemic of anxiety and depression. And the third in the series has another question: to what extent might artificial intelligence revolutionise medicine? But in this one, we're focusing on cancer and asking whether we're experiencing a step change in our understanding and treatment of the disease. To begin with, though, I want to understand more about how much cancer there is, whether that's been changing, and what our chances are of surviving it. Professor Charles Swanton is Chief Clinician at Cancer Research UK and Deputy Clinical Director at the Francis Crick Institute. Charles Swanton, the simplest of all questions first, what is cancer?
Cancer is an uncontrolled proliferation deriving from a single cell that can ultimately grow into a mass in a particular tissue or human organ and spread around the body and cause death either due to the burden of disease across multiple tissues in the body in a process called metastasis, or cause other secondary effects like blood clots, cancer pain, fatigue, loss of weight, etc.
Right. Can you tell us now whether more of us are getting cancers than used to in the past? Do we know that?
Yes, we do know that. There has been an increase in the number of cancer cases per year. And that, in part, that's due to an ageing population and a reflection, I think, of our successes in other fields of medicine, such as cardiovascular disease. So people are living longer. Obviously, there are more people on the planet. And as a result of that combined effect, you have a situation where we're seeing more cancers.
Is it the case that as you get older, you are more prone to getting a cancer?
Yes, that's absolutely right. After the age of about 50, we see a very steep increase in cancer risk and incidence.
And is this a worldwide phenomenon?
Yes, this is a worldwide phenomenon, yeah.
Are we also seeing an increase in the numbers of younger people who get cancer?
Yes, there is. There has been over the last 15, 20 years an uptick in the number of patients being diagnosed with cancer below the age of 50. Cancer Research UK estimates there's been about a 22% increase in the number of cancers in the under 50 age group, dating back to sort of the mid-90s. Now, the important thing to say here is that cancer under the age of 50 is still a minority of all cancer diagnoses, so around about 10%. But we are seeing a very significant increase, particularly in cancers such as melanoma, cancers of the gastrointestinal tract, bowel cancer, for example, anal cancer. There is no single reason for it. And depending on the cancer type, there is likely to be potentially a different reason. So, for example, colorectal cancers, cancers of the gastrointestinal tract, we think likely due to lifestyle changes in the post-war period, which would include changes to diet and possibly changes to the what we call a microbiome, that is the bacteria that live in our gut, are a likely possible candidate for the increase in colorectal cancer diagnosis we're seeing.
Now, in general, is there more success in treating some cancers than others?
Yes, undoubtedly. So today, a breast cancer diagnosis, one could expect well over 80% of women diagnosed with breast cancer to survive their diagnosis and be cured. If you go back to when I was born in the early 70s, that number would have been less than 40%. So in 50-odd years, we've seen a huge improvement in outcomes in breast cancer. Unfortunately, for other cancers such as pancreas cancer, cancers of the upper gastrointestinal tract, gastric cancer, esophageal cancer, brain cancers, for example, and some lung cancers, there has been less of a significant improvement in outcomes.
Now, to treat cancer at all, of course, you've got to diagnose it. Do we experience significant delays at the moment in this country in getting diagnoses for cancers?
Yes, we do. There are significant delays to treatment. Some of that is a lag from COVID, but I think there are other sort of infrastructural problems in the UK, including fewer diagnostic opportunities to be able to make those diagnoses as fast as possible.
So to be clear, we're late in diagnosing and that also makes us late in treatment. Are we also late in treatment once diagnosed?
Yes, from diagnosis to treatment, there are significant delays.
And how do we compare in those statistics with other comparable countries?
Well, unfortunately, we are not doing well in the context of cancer survival outcomes in this country. Fundamentally, we know one of the major reasons for that is later stage in diagnosis. The earlier we diagnose cancers, the greater chance we have of achieving cures in our patients.
Right. OK, let's talk now about what up until now have been the mainstream treatments for cancer. What are they?
The mainstream treatments for cancer are first and foremost surgery. Resecting a primary tumour is overwhelmingly the most effective management of a cancer, assuming it hasn't spread beyond the primary site. Once that tumour has been resected, we have an additional treatment following surgery, which includes chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and in some cancers like prostate cancer and in breast cancer, hormonal therapies, endocrine therapies, to block the hormonal axis, which the cancer depends upon for growth. If the tumour presents late, that is, when the tumour spread beyond the primary site, at that stage, surgery is no longer possible in the majority of cases, and there we rely on chemotherapy, sometimes radiotherapy, as well as endocrine therapy.
Now, in the cases of chemotherapy and radiotherapy, there is some suggestion that these are fairly brutal treatments with significant downsides.
Yes. So the problem with chemotherapy and radiotherapy to some extent is that it's primary mode of action is targeting rapidly proliferating cells. And of course, cancers aren't the only tissue in the body that rapidly proliferates. Our what we call the stem cell compartment that forms our blood cells, the lining of our gut, our mouths, our skin, also have rapidly dividing cells that are affected by chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And of course, that is why, you know, these systemic and local treatments are associated with systemic and local side effects to normal tissue, because they affect the stem cell compartment that allows that tissue to regenerate.
Let's turn our faces slightly to the future and look at the role of scientific research. I mean, leaving lifestyle changes to one side, what, in very general terms, are the major lines of scientific attack on cancer?
So I think, firstly, it's quite helpful to think about cancer in two ways. First of all, you've got the uncontrolled proliferation of the cancer cell that forms a mass. But it's also important to recognise that that mass isn't just solely cancer cells. It's a mixture of cancer cells and cells from our normal tissue that are infiltrating it, trying to control it. So the two main streams of research that I think it's helpful to consider today are, one, how a normal cell turns into cancer and starts to proliferate uncontrollably. And then in parallel, there's been this emergent work over the last 2.5 decades of how one's own body helps to control that cancer, how the immune system infiltrates the cancer and slows down its growth.
So essentially, how to target only cancer cells, how to isolate them and target them on the one hand, and how to get the body to help with the business.
Exactly. It's very helpful thinking about it like that.
Charles Swanton. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about net migration, the one about synthetic opioids, and the one asking, what's the point of Ofsted?
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise-Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Back now to cancer. Let's turn to the advances in science. And here I want to focus on drug treatments and the relatively new field of immunotherapy. Charles Swanton is joined by Dr. Olivia Rossonesi, Director of the Centre for Cancer Drug Discovery at the Institute of Cancer Research, Christian Ottensmeier, Professor of Immuno-Oncology at the University of Liverpool, and Consultant Clinical Oncologist at the Royal Marsden NHS Foundation Trust, Alan Melcher. Now, first, I'd like to talk about new drug treatments and where we're going on that and what the main advances are. So, Olivia Rossonesi, this is very much your field. What are we doing in the field of targeted drug therapy?
Yeah, so that's been a lot of the big advances, both clinically and preclinically, in the past 25 years. And what targeted therapies are and how they're differentiated from chemotherapy is they're really aimed at getting in to the cancer cell and stopping the action of one or a small number of proteins that we know have gone wrong in these cancer cells and that we know are driving this really fast cancer cell growth. So the idea is that we can see what's wrong in a cancer cell and then essentially jam a molecular spanner into the works and stop the growth of that cell.
Very roughly, why are we able to do this now when we weren't before? What have we been discovering?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts of it. One is understanding the biology of cancer better. So our advances in understanding what's gone wrong in cancer cells and the kind of molecular mechanisms that are driving that growth. And that has really come from some technological advances, including being able to sequence patients' tumors and seeing these mutations, which lead to these bad actor proteins that are driving the growth.
So genetic sequencing is a very important part of this advance.
It absolutely is. And tells us two things. It tells us what's gone wrong in cancer cells so that we can understand how to fix it. But it also helps us identify, you know, which patients have which kind of tumors and what's gone wrong in that particular cancer. And then that helps us match that patient with some of these new medicines.
Now, are the new medicines targeted to specific individual tumors, or do different cancers actually have certain things in common?
So we're not at the level of one drug for every mutation that we know about and for every patient. But we do know that there are 10, I would say, very clear proteins that we know when they get mutated, when they go wrong, they can drive a number of different types of tumors. So we're down to that level. So you would say everybody with a mutation in this protein, everybody with a mutation in this protein. So we're getting closer to that resolution, but it's not one-to-one.
Now, some of the drugs you're talking about are already on the market, right?
That is definitely true, yes.
Roughly how long did it take to get them there?
So the first approved therapy was actually approved in 2001. So it's been about 25 years since the first one was approved. The pathway for that one was much longer because they were figuring out all of these things that I just mentioned, the genetics of the disease, how to create the drug, how to find the right patients. Since then, it's been getting faster for each one. You know, we can reasonably say that we've cut that time in half, but from idea to patient to clinical trial, it's probably still 10 years.
And is there significant cost in developing these drugs and getting them to market?
There is, but I would say it's not particularly greater than the costs that we're used to for sort of any of these things. One of the things that it can help with in terms of cost is if we know we have a particular drug against a particular mutation in a particular patient, we're only giving it to those patients. So we're not giving it to patients for whom we know are not going to benefit. So I think, you know, we can balance cost and things like that because not only can we be more targeted in our approach to drug treatment, but also to patients.
Right. So, but what you've also signaled there is something which feels very significant to the layperson, which is that not everybody will benefit equally from these sorts of drugs.
Yeah, I think that's been an important finding of this whole class of targeted therapies. So while it sounds sort of like it's a bad thing, like, oh, I've made this new drug and it's not for everyone, we do know that for the people that do have those mutations, these drugs can be really effective and they can be so with fewer side effects and, you know, better outcomes for those patients. So it's really maybe a matter of having enough in our toolbox to be able to identify all the different kinds of mutations in patients and having things for each one of them.
One of the things that we discovered about the COVID virus was that it was constantly mutating. Can I ask, do cancer cells also evolve to outwit the drugs that you use to try and control them?
Absolutely, yes, definitely, very aggressively. So what we're finding, especially with these targeted therapies, is that cancer cells are relying on this one protein for growth. We then essentially, you know, smack that with a hammer and the cell gets very upset about that and immediately tries to find ways to get around that block that you've created. And it can do it in a number of different ways. And I think that's really the challenge, is understanding what those ways are and then how we target that. And I think that's the subject of a lot of the research going forward now that we have some of these tools.
So one of the consequences of that might be that you'll actually use fewer or less strong drugs precisely because they're better targeted and actually the stronger ones can create a reaction you don't actually want.
That is definitely one part of it. When you dose very heavily and you hit something very hard, you're creating that pressure to find a way around there. But if you hit it slightly less hard, enough to control cancer cell growth, but not so hard that they feel they need to rewire or find these mechanisms around it, then you get rid of this problem of evolution towards resistance. One of the other ways that we've really been exploring is combination therapies. And, you know, I use a traffic analogy for this. So you're driving down the road. We put a drug in front of you to block transport down that road. What you do is start looking for another route. And this is what cancer cells do as well. But if we know what that route's going to be, then we can have a second drug that we put, you know, in front of that cancer cell at that time. So this kind of clever sequencing, but yes, with maybe lower doses and fewer drugs, you know, can start addressing that question of resistance.
Now, you said earlier that some of the drugs in this category have already been developed, but what about future drugs?
There are a huge number moving through the clinic now, and they are starting to take advantage of even more technologies in the way that we can develop drugs. So there are some that we call covalent, which have a certain way that they attach to these problematic proteins in the cell. And those have opened up an entire new class against one of these cancer-causing proteins that we haven't been able to access before. So I think that's super promising. We also have new technologies in small molecules that can actually take the whole protein and degrade it, get rid of it entirely. So instead of just putting a spanner in the works, you're essentially getting rid of the whole engine. And I think those are really promising as well. Those are already being tested in clinical trials. So again, they're still 5 years away from being available for general use, but are teaching us about how these new targeted therapies are going to come along. Again, from the first one, which probably took quite long, we've learned a lot that can help with these later ones.
Can I turn now to immunotherapy? Anna Melcher, can you just tell us, what is immunotherapy?
So immunotherapy is really quite a different type of treatment for cancer. So we've all been fairly familiar with chemotherapy and radiotherapy, but immunotherapy is different in that it actually is trying to use your own immune system to attack your cancer, which is something we've known is possible for many years, but has only really turned into effective drugs over the last 10 to 20 years.
Christian Ottesmeyer, can you tell us how long immunotherapy has been a treatment option? When did the first patient begin to get it?
Immunotherapy has quite a long track record, actually, and bone marrow transplantation that the hematologists have used for aggressive leukemias is the first really persuasive example that the immune system can control cancer. So that's been going on since the late 1990s and has made many patients with leukemias better and often cured them. In patients with solid cancers, really the big change happened in 2011 when for the first time a drug called ipilimumab, which is a monoclonal antibody that was suddenly able to turn patients from having incurable melanoma into patients that were able to control their cancer. So this illustrated that this kind of approach could be applied also to patients with solid tumors. And then since 2011, the world has just exploded with new drugs and compounds and ideas and concepts. And I think it is very clear that immunotherapy is there to stay in solid cancers also.
You mentioned melanoma. Is it fair to say that before the development of immunotherapy for melanoma, there wasn't really an effective treatment?
Absolutely. When we couldn't remove the cancer by surgery, and if the cancer had spread, the options were really limited. And I grew up in this phase as an oncologist and still remember the amazement when we switched from, unfortunately, we might buy you a little bit of time, and while we have this interesting trial, we would like to offer you to try something new. We really don't expect that it will solve your problem, to a, this is a really bad place to be, but there's now a small chance of about 20% that we might be able to give you your life back and you will get on with it. And when the first patients walked into our clinics, having been out from treatment about 3 or 4 years, and the first young woman who had a liver full of cancer came into clinic with her firstborn and all were happy and well, that really changed the way we thought about immunotherapy in melanoma in that instance.
Alan, let's look at how immunotherapy treatments are developing now. There's been a lot in the news recently about personalised cancer vaccines, which are at the medical trial stage. What exactly is a personalised cancer vaccine?
Okay, so we know that cancers do actually have things in them which can be targets for the immune system, so-called antigens. In the same way that viruses have antigens, your cancer can have some antigens too. And those things can be attacked by the immune system and help to eradicate and control cancer. But of course, one of the problems with making a vaccine, if it's a virus, it's the same virus like human papillomavirus vaccines, the same target for everybody. But everybody's cancer is different, and therefore everybody's antigens, these targets for the immune system, are different cancer to cancer. So this is along the realms of personalised medicine, but it's almost to the next level in that it's personalised literally cancer by cancer. But as we've started to understand more about cancers, and particularly the way that the immune system can recognise, attack and control cancers, that has led us to understand the types of antigens that different cancers can have. And even beyond that, we've got to the next stage now where individual cancers can be taken, they can be sent off for analysis in the laboratory, and you can make a personalised, individualised vaccine, which then comes back to the patient for treatment. And these are now things that not that long ago I would have said were pipe dreams in terms of practicality, affordability and feasibility, but they're not. These things are now happening in these personalised vaccines, we hope. There's good early evidence already, once again, most convincing so far in melanoma, that these vaccines can add to the value of some of the original antibody drugs that are still now very much used, they work by boosting and activating your immune system all over the place. These vaccines are now much more specific and designed to improve on that and direct your immune system to particular antigens in your own particular tumour that you want to attack and eradicate.
Christian, the way in which we normally think about vaccines is you take them before you've had anything. The whole point is not to get it. That's changed slightly as we've understood how the COVID vaccines have developed. Is it the case that essentially, you can't have a cancer vaccine until your particular type of cancer has already presented itself, because otherwise you wouldn't know what you were vaccinating yourself against. And therefore, you're vaccinating against a recurrence of that.
The treatment for advanced cancer has been really challenging for cancer vaccines. And the data that Alan referred to is in patients whose cancer has been diagnosed, removed by surgery, and then the treatment, the vaccine, is aimed at preventing it from coming back. So it's similar to prevention. It's perhaps secondary prevention. There are clever ideas about how this kind of concept might also be levied at patients who haven't yet got cancer or are just living in a situation with very high risk of developing cancer, and whether we can use some of these mutations, these abnormalities that make the cancer cells different, and pick those up really early on blood tests, and then offer a vaccine to prevent cancer from ever developing, certainly an area of hot interest.
Okay, one of the things that people talk a lot about now that genetic testing is much more common, is I've been told I have the gene for this or for that. Do we think, Alan, there will come a point where we can actually say, because we can tell you are at such risk of a particular cancer, then in that case we have actually a vaccine? In other words, we can give you this thing that will prevent it, or is that futurology?
I think that type of concept is still some way off, to be honest. I mean, the genetics that we can do and the analysis we can do is at extraordinary depth. But what we've been talking about in terms of cancer vaccines at the moment is about the understanding the genetic code of the actual cancer itself, rather than the genes, and indeed there are several and many of those, that put you at risk of cancer. So, if you like, there's a continuum from the risk. The other thing perhaps to mention and highlight, as Christian has already done, is to pick things up as early as possible. And there are some types of cancer which have a precancerous stage, which we can know and we can identify and we can genetically characterise. And one area of interest will be, I think, and an area of great excitement, will be to pick up those really very early lesions. And we know that all immunotherapy, to be honest, works better the earlier you catch the disease.
What do you have to do to pick up those lesions? I mean, because I imagine if they're very early, you may not have had significant symptoms that lead you to find them.
Indeed. I mean, the sensitivity of the tests increases all the time, and people are starting to look at that. You're going to pick up things like prostate cancer, potentially from saliva, other cancers picking up very early genetic signals in the blood, which will then direct you to ultimately go and look at the tissue. So there are areas like cervical cancer where we know there is a clear precancerous stage. So the search is everywhere, if you like, but ideally, if you want to get very early in screening many, many people, you look in the blood first, but there are also particular tissues that you can know are at risk. And you can know that there are particular people with genetic sensitivity, if you like, things like the BRCA gene, which can be mutated in many people and women with breast cancer, ovarian cancer. So you can almost know where to look, but the search should be wide in the blood, in the tissue. We're on a journey here, and it's very exciting times, but there is still plenty that we don't know about as well as what we do.
Christian, insofar as we've now developed immunotherapy treatments, can we say they're gentler for the patient than the conventional treatments up until now?
Yes, I think that's true. And there is a small group of patients who develop really quite unpleasant side effects, but the number of patients who experience that is much smaller than with chemotherapy. And the effects also tend to be gradual onset and more gradual decline. So we rarely make people proper unwell very quickly. That does happen, particularly when you combine immunotherapy drugs. And I predict that the addition of the vaccines will be one way of reducing such side effects.
And Christian, what about the cost? Are these therapies significantly more costly than the ones we've been using up until now?
When you make a new product for each patient, that clearly holds enormous technical and challenges in terms of production, shipping, making things available. So yes, these costs are really important and very high. clearly more important and more costly than if you had a drug that is just off the shelf, so to speak. We will have to see whether the costs will come down when the production methods become more standardized. But I think that is going to be a real challenge, particularly if we're hoping to use this kind of approach very widely.
Christian, do you have any figures in mind for the costs of some of these drugs?
I think the proposed per vaccine cost for a personalized cancer vaccine is somewhere around £100,000.
Given that, Christian, how far away from really widespread use in this country do you think these vaccines are?
We still need to genuinely demonstrate that the first observations that were, for example, reported in melanoma and that Alan referred to can be reproduced, and that the kind of benefit that we're seeing there is not just found in a small randomized study. So 140 or so patients were enrolled in that study. And I think by the end of next year, or perhaps early 26, we will have a much better understanding of how robustly these effects can be reproduced. If that is the case, then I think it's full steam ahead and working out how we can afford it and what is affordable. And I'm sure that there will be differences between countries and continents about what can and cannot be delivered.
What does full steam ahead mean roughly in terms of years?
I can make a prediction, and I think that in 26 we'll be thinking about which indications we might be offering these compounds, these vaccines to, as part of routine care. Then in many countries there will come a period of reflection of what is genuinely fundable and affordable, and that will no doubt shape what ultimately will wind up in the NHS, for example.
Alan Melcher, when I was thumbing through the brief that was provided before the programme, it mentioned your specific research using viruses to fire up the immune system. That rather captured my imagination. Could you tell me what sorts of viruses and what sorts of results?
So actually, at around the same time that immunotherapy was emerging, it became increasingly recognised that cancer cells are particularly susceptible to virus infection. Because when your normal cell gets infected with the virus, it has very effective systems to shut that virus down and stop anything further happening. And for various reasons, cancer cells don't have those protection mechanisms. So that led to the interest in these so-called oncolytic viruses, whereby the original idea was for that the virus would directly infect the cancer cell. It would replicate like crazy in the cancer cell because it couldn't defend itself, whereas normal cells were fine, and therefore the virus was going to directly kill the cancer cell. And that concept grew, but it also fundamentally changed, because what became clear was that the way these viruses were working was not so much by directly killing the cancer cell, but that, of course, is no bad thing. But what they were also doing was to alert the immune system to something that it ought to attack. Because, of course, we're all very well evolved to defend, recognise and eliminate viruses. Whereas in marked contrast, as cancers grow and they evolve in the body, they actually have to hide from the immune system, and they do that in many ways and very effectively. However, if you can put and get one of these oncolytic viruses into a cancer and start killing the cancer cells, the immune system wakes up to attack. And I think it's now broadly recognised that these so-called oncolytic viruses are actually a type of immunotherapy. There's only one oncolytic virus at the moment approved widely across the world, again for the treatment of recurrent melanoma. That's a type of herpes simplex virus. It's fair to say these viruses, again, they have practical issues of manufacture and cost. They've been somewhat overtaken at the moment by the antibodies that Christian mentioned, but I think they're on the up and they're an extremely interesting additional way to improve immunotherapy further. The cancer vaccines is one way. I think these oncolytic viruses have the potential and may well prove to be another.
Charles Swanton, aren't all these beginning to change the whole way we think about cancers? I mean, in general, when people say, I've got cancer, they say, where is it? And the where is it? It's a liver cancer, it's a lung cancer, tends to be what determines our approach towards it. And what I think I'm hearing is something that says, no, stop thinking about cancer in that kind of a way. Have I got it right or am I wrong?
There definitely is a school of thought, to your point, David, that we are beginning to think of cancers much more molecularly. That is, the types of genetic changes in those cancers can be seen perhaps more broadly than, for instance, just in, let's say, a lung cancer or a gastric cancer. But that said, I still firmly believe that we will, for the foreseeable future, still be confined within our organs of origin, simply because breast cancer behaves as a disease very differently from how lung cancers behave, for example. There are similarities, but there are also fundamental differences as well, which means you do need, as a medical oncologist, to have expertise in organ-confined areas of disease. But despite that, there are still similarities and drug approvals, for instance, the types of drugs that Christian's been talking about, and Alan, immunotherapies that drive the immune system to fight the cancer can work across many different tumour types. And there are similar approaches in the targeted therapy field.
This has all been incredibly exciting to listen to. But I want to ask each of you what may seem like a very crude question. I'll start off with you, Olivia. Do you think that the advances we're making means that one day we will actually be able to say, we've got the cures for cancer, we can do it?
I think that's a tricky question for more than one reason. The first is that, you know, we're learning not to lump all different cancers into the same bucket, right? Cancer is more than one thing. And, you know, as of now, the survival rates and the prognosis for different types of cancer is variable. And I think that will continue to be true. So I think it's difficult to look at it as this one thing and we say, ah, yes, tick, that one thing is done. But I do think a lot of the advances that we've made have taught us things that might make the many types of disease more manageable. So do we always have to say we've got to eradicate it, we've got to cure it, we've got to do that? Or are we coming to a stage where also we can manage it as well? So I think this harkens back a little bit to what I was talking about, resistance and how we manage that. Can we be clever about the way we sequence drugs or the way we sequence treatment such that we're not putting huge pressures on it to evolve and change and become resistant, but we're keeping it under control such that the patient feels healthy and feels fine? And I think maybe that's a more realistic goal, at least in our lifetimes.
Christian, what do you think?
I'm ever the optimist. So I think that we've seen that in some tumors, melanoma, we now cure a really substantial proportion of patients. I think it is unlikely that we will ever be in a position to say, you've got cancer, it's not a problem, we'll make it go away. What I do think is within our line of sight is that we're going to be able to take a sample from the cancer and figure out what kind of drug and or combinations we should give to the patient. So imagine it a little bit like a pie, and every new approach takes a slice out of that pie. So where immunotherapy with the existing drugs perhaps takes 25% out of the pie, I suspect that the vaccines will add another 25% to that. So I think the group of patients that we genuinely cannot help will reduce. And I therefore believe that across many tumor types, admittedly, not all tumor types, we will be able to cure a substantial and increasing number of patients.
Alan, what do you think?
So I think I would go somewhere in the middle. I'm an optimist, but I think cancer is unfortunately here to stay. And exactly as has been said, it's a very complicated and there are many, many different types. When I think back and the others on the call, clinicians like myself, I think that the aura of cancer is hopefully changing. When I started, it was seen as a death sentence. You know, you didn't use the word cancer. Families would ask you not to tell the patient they had cancer because it was felt to be untreatable and that was it. I think that is changing and treatment is improving. And in a sense, I think what may be happening in many types of cancer is it will become more of a chronic disease. If you think about it, we don't cure heart disease, we don't cure diabetes, but they don't carry with them, or they certainly haven't until, you know, relatively recently, the absolute dread that cancer brings. So I think, as Christian says, we're going to do better for more people and significantly as time goes on. But I don't think there's ever going to be a complete and bullet for everything.
Charles, last word to you.
I'm also an optimist, and I think with additional investment in research, we're going to see incremental improvements in outcome across multiple different solid tumours that together, I hope, over the rest of my lifetime and my career, our careers, will see a really profound change in survival outcomes. There's one very important aspect we haven't discussed today, which is prevention. And I think we will also prevent more cancers. Very simple things like stopping smoking, controlling alcohol use, lifestyle changes, diet, etc., avoiding UV light, sunscreen, etc., will also improve outcomes by the old adage, prevention is better than cure. And I think that that's an important aspect too, that will together improve the lives of our patients and people globally.
That was Charles Swanton with Olivia Rossanese, Christian Ossensmeyer and Alan Melcher. My thanks to all of them. And my conclusion, that was all a bit more hopeful than I expected, at least for the next generation. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Rosamund Jones and Sally Abrahams. The editor was Richard Varden. And the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill and Rod Farker.